Are you seeking an integrated approach to management education, one with lots of global opportunities? Yale School of Management may just be the ticket, and its Dean of Admissions is going to give you the inside scoop on admissions at Yale SOM. Listen in. Welcome to the 338th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Before I dive into today's interview, I want to mention that Accepted is having a sale that will run from November 15th to 22nd. This November special provides our biggest discounts of the fall. You can save up to $1,000 on Accepted's outstanding admissions consulting if you purchase during this time period. So don't delay. Check out our services today at www.accepted.com. If you're interested, schedule a free initial call ASAP and have the time to purchase and snag valuable discounts. The coupon code is SAVENOW, SAVENOW, and again, it ends November 22nd. It gives me great pleasure to have back on Admissions Straight Talk and introduce Bruce Delmonico, Assistant Dean and Director of Admissions at Yale School of Management. He has been on the admissions team at Yale since 2004, becoming the director in 2006 and the assistant dean in 2012. Bruce, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thanks so much, Linda. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you back. Now let's start with the basics. Can you give me a brief overview of the distinctive elements of Yale School of Management's full-time program? We know it teaches accounting and finance and economics and all that, but what are the more distinctive elements of its program?
Sure. And obviously I could go on much longer, but just to give you a brief sense of it, I think there are three things that I really point to. One is that among U.S. business schools, but business schools generally, we feel we are the most integrated to our home university. So when you come to Yale, so when you really come to Yale and you're able to take advantage of all the opportunities that Yale affords, whether it's being able to take as many electives as you want outside of the School of Management, connecting with professional graduate schools elsewhere at Yale, or being part of conferences, connecting to the alumni network. So really, so the whole university community is open to you, which we feel is a fantastic aspect of the program. We are also, we feel, the most global U.S. business school. We've worked hard to develop that global posture, that global mindset, and something we want our students and graduates to have as well. So there's lots of programming that is built into the MBA, full-time MBA program. It's global nature, from the case studies to the global experiences to the composition of the class. You know, we're about 45% non-U.S. Citizens, which I think is on the high end among U.S. business schools by quite a bit. I think that mindset, that composition permeates, again, the community and really influences how you experience the MBA program. And then the last is we feel, and we say is we're the best source of elevated leaders across all regions and sectors. And that really speaks to our integrated curriculum. So when you come to Yale, you will get as you said, you'll get accounting and finance and marketing, but you'll be taught in a different way. Our courses are structured differently in a much more interdisciplinary, integrated way. With the recognition that when you graduate, your career will not just be in one area, will not be functionally siloed the way maybe it was 40 or 50 years ago when the traditional MBA curriculum.
When I took it.
Yeah. So we teach in a much different way, and I think that influences how you think and how you will lead after you graduate.
Is the integration carried beyond the core?
It is in different ways and to different degrees, depending on what electives you take. So we actually have our own case writing team that will develop what we call raw cases that are different than what we call the cooked cases that you get at other MBA programs. And they're much, they rely on primary source material. The case writing team doesn't distill everything down for you and make those decisions about what's relevant and what's not. You have to make those decisions yourselves. And the idea is that even in the classroom, you're learning real world skills. Those are the types of things you have to do after you graduate. So you should do them in the classroom as well and not have other people making those decisions for you or synthesizing the information for you. And so those cases, to different degrees, carry into the electives, and there are other electives that are integrated, much like the core. Some may be a little bit more straightforward if it's advanced accounting or learning spreadsheets or those types of things. That may not be as lend itself as well to the integrated model.
Right. But on the other hand, if it doesn't lend itself to it, you know, what's the point of it? This is, you know, a specific skill being taught. So it makes sense. Now that we have a foundation, what's new at Yale School of Management?
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So there's a lot that's stayed the same and it's been consistent. That it's anchored really in the mission of the school to educate leaders for business and society. I feel like I need to get that in there too. But there's a lot that's new. I think the biggest thing is that we have a new dean who started July 1st, Kerwin Charles. He joined us from Chicago. He was at the Public Policy School at the University of Chicago. He's a labor economist. He's been on campus for a few months now, and we're all very excited. He's had a number of town halls, and I get the question, pretty frequently, what's his vision for the school? And actually, he's been very thoughtful and very sort of diligent about thinking, hearing from the school, from the students, different stakeholders, students, faculty, staff, alumni, trying to get a sense of the place and really understand the mission, understand the values, and then I think only at that point will he start to really put it more of his stamp on the school. But I think he's really doing a wonderful job of listening and learning at this point, and we're very excited to have him. So that's one big thing.
That's a big one.
Another one is we have a new 1-year master's program, an MMS in asset management, to complement our other 1-year master's in systemic risk and global business and society and our master's of advanced management program. So we're building up a portfolio of 1-year programs. And really, for the asset management program, tapping into Yale's deep strength in that area. So David Swinson, who runs the Yale Investment Office, is very involved in this. Toby Moskowitz is the faculty lead. He joined us actually from Booth a couple of years ago. We have a number of other faculty who are really sort of taking the lead here. And we're also tapping into our strategic advantage of being close to sort of hedge funds and pension funds in the sort of up and down the Connecticut coast and into New York. So we're very excited about that and excited about the fact that these 1-year degrees will actually be beneficial to the full-time MBA students because full-time MBA students will be able to take these classes. So a little bit more technical, a little bit more oriented towards certain areas. So it's actually building out not just the portfolio of programs, but the portfolio of offerings that are available to full-time MBA students as well.
It also seems like if the MBA is a more general management integrated kind of curriculum, the 1-year programs are offering people a deep dive into a specific area of management and business.
They are, although I think especially for asset management, but for the other programs as well, still in a holistic way.
Okay.
So thinking not just about the technical skills, but asking questions such as, you know, if you're an asset manager, what are your responsibilities? What are your ethical responsibilities? What are your obligations? Who are your stakeholders? You know, what are your fiduciary duties? So thinking not just about the technical side, but definitely very much the technical side, but also the broader questions that we think you should have in mind. And I think that a school like we are here at Yale are uniquely positioned to ask those questions and have you thinking about those big picture items at the same time as you're learning those more technical deep dive skills.
Right. And that also sort of relates to the mission of the school.
Yes, very much.
I don't know the technical details of what caused 2008, but if I recall, part of it was very much a focus on one kind of stakeholder and not the broader questions of what's good for society.
That's right. And that is actually, I don't mean to interrupt, but that actually, another great example of that is our 1-year program in systemic risk. And that's open to central bankers from around the world. So we reach out to 200 central banks around the globe looking for sort of early to mid-career professionals who will come to Yale and learn about what caused the most recent sort of financial downturn and what lessons were learned. And the hope is that in the future, there will be a network of Yale-trained central bankers who, when the next crash happens or is threatened, will be able to respond in a much more effective way than we were in the past. So thinking about,
hopefully not pursue policies that contributes to it.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
So really, again, that's kind of unique to the mission of the school and thinking not just about sort of the business, but also society, the societal benefits, societal obligations that we have and how the two are interrelated.
That's good. Now, there seems to be increasing interest in deferred admissions programs like Yale's Silver Scholars Program that we were talking about a few minutes ago before we got on the recording. Yale has one of the older ones, one of the better established ones. Can you tell us about the Silver Scholars Program and what are you looking for in applicants to the Silver Scholars Program?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. I think, and we do have one of the oldest, and I might be the first, I don't know. It certainly predates, obviously, the more recent ones, but even, you know, the 2+2 program.
It definitely predates 2+2 by a long way.
By a good bit. And actually, ours is rather unique. We get lumped in with the, what are termed the deferred admission programs. We're the only one that I'm aware of for which you actually start at Yale the fall after you graduate from college. So these other programs are deferred admission in the sense that you graduate or you will apply in your last year of undergraduate and then usually will work for 2 years before starting the MBA program. For us at the Silver Scholars, you graduate presumably in the spring from your undergraduate and then start with us in the fall. So there's no gap. And the program is structured, therefore, a little bit differently than other programs in that it's actually a 3-year program. So you will do your first year, our core MBA courses, then the first year after you graduate. Then you do an extended 1-year internship after that first year core. And then you will come back in the third year for your second academic year with us, which is at Yale is entirely electives. And again, you can take them anywhere at the university. And the idea behind the structure is that when you are in your undergraduate, you're very good at learning in a classroom setting. And so we extend that classroom learning into the first year of your MBA, sort of to optimize on that dimension. You don't have plenty of full-time work experience, so we give you the extended internship, the 1-year internship, to allow you to apply those concepts in the workplace. And presumably, during that 1 year, you will learn what you're good at, what you're not good at, where your gaps are. And so when you come back for the second year, which is the third year of the program, you will be able to take electives that will address those gaps and make you a more complete leader after you graduate. And so when it's all tallied up, you will have your MBA and be off and running in 3 years as opposed to 4 more years of the deferred admission. So it's a little more accelerated, but I think also philosophically structured in a way that I think makes to me at least more sense in terms of what you're able to accomplish and when you're optimized to do certain things at different points in your career. So that's a little bit long-winded, I apologize. In terms of what we're looking for Silver Scholars, you know, the application is the same as for non-Silver Scholar applicants. Looking for all the same things, we tend to weight the academics and the test score a little more heavily because we don't have that full-time work experience. We have your internships, we have your activities in undergraduate, but nothing full-time. But we do look at those things as well, and we actually will look at them maybe not for the actual, you know, full-time experience you have because you don't have that, but as markers for what you've been able to accomplish in the limited time you've had both on campus and in your internships, your propensity to lead, your being asked and tapped to lead or take on significant roles. So those are the types of things, those are the indicators we look for beyond grades and scores to predict who we think are the highest potential applicants to the Silver Scholars program.
And how do the Silver Scholars do in terms of the job search? Are they getting the same kinds of jobs as MBAs? Are they getting a slightly lower level job and salary? How do they do? Yeah.
They get the same jobs after they graduate. I think one of the challenges for the Silver Scholars is they have to appreciate that until they have the MBA, they are going to be getting more an internship that is more akin to a post-undergraduate internship, so more at the analyst stage and for a consulting firm, for example. But then by the time they graduate, when they have the MBA, they're getting the same jobs as the non-Silver Scholar students and graduates. So, you know, it's more of a process given the unique posture they're in and the sort of the unique trajectory they're going through. And so I think Silver Scholars, one challenge is understanding and appreciating that path and that process. But that once they graduate and they have their MBA, they're getting all the same jobs as every other Yale S1 graduate.
It sounds like just financially, obviously they're taking the 2 years of MBA when they're out of the workforce, when they're at the lowest point in their earning capacity. And then at year 3, they're at a place where usually people 5 and 6 years out are at. You know, that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Is there any flexibility in terms of that one-year internship? Or is it really lockstep that it's a one-year internship and that's it? I mean, let's say somebody were to say, can I work another year and then go back to Yale?
That does happen. That definitely happens. So we have people who will extend for another year because they're enjoying their internship. They want to get more experience. And we tend to be pretty liberal with and very flexible with those leaves of absence. So that tends not to be a problem. I would also say for the internships too, it doesn't always have to be a single one-year internship. We have had summer scholars who will do 2 6-month, 3 4-month, 4 3-month. I was someone who was interested in finance and was wanting to get a global perspective, so did an investment banking internship in Asia. So I think Hong Kong, London, New York, one other city, I believe, to really get a sense of what the different approaches were in those different continents. So there's a good bit of flexibility even within the 1 year as well.
Wow. Okay. And sometimes I know some of the deferred admissions programs, they really want to see what the applicant wants to do in that deferral period or the internship period at Yale, parallel to the internship period. Is that important to you, that the applicant has that sense of direction, or is that not important?
It's important to have some sense of direction, because maybe even more so, and I should have talked about this maybe a little bit in the previous answer, maybe even more so than the non-summer scholar applicants, because there should be some reason for to justify the accelerated program. We're not as concerned about the internship per se. We know that between our career development office, the applicants, existing network, and some of the other networks that we have available through Yale generally, that the internship will work out. But it's more just directionally understanding sort of the reason for this accelerated path and what you're hoping to get out of it. But we have, you know, we've had now, I'm trying to think, you know, the Silver Scholar program started, I think, right around when I joined. So it's been maybe 15 or so years that we've had this in place. And so we've developed, I think, strong relationships. It's still a little bit atypical in terms of the process and the pathway, the extended 1 year internship, but we've done it long enough that we now have know how to source those opportunities and work with the students to develop them.
All right, great. Thank you. Now, you've written and also spoken on various videos and said, we put a lot of thought into how our application is constructed. Our guiding principle is to only ask questions that are relevant to evaluating an applicant's candidacy. And as a result, our application tends to be shorter than that of many other schools. We also try to get the fullest picture of you as possible. Now, can you go through some of the different elements in the application? Obviously, you don't want them to just provide you the same information as the other element over there did. So What is the purpose of the different elements, the resume, your single essay, the video component, the behavioral assessment, which is, as far as I know, unique to Yale? You know, you have your recommendations and obviously the interview.
I think that's right. So I'm happy to walk through that. And obviously that what you just read it off, I think I think from a recent blog post, is there is a bit of a tension of trying to be short but still trying to get the fullest picture possible. I assume that's the point of reading those statements. But I think we do walk, a good line, in the sense that we really do think carefully about what we're asking, why we're asking it, trying not to be redundant or repetitive or ask things that are just for information gathering for, you know, other departments or other purposes. But also really trying, in terms of the things we're asking and the ways in which we're asking, trying to be much more, I guess, three-dimensional about it. So it's not just, you know, the written word, but we have video questions, we have the behavioral assessment, trying to get, use different modes of information gathering to be, I think, hopefully more sophisticated, hopefully more successful in terms of what we're learning about you and the ways we're learning things about you. So, but just briefly in terms of the elements themselves. So we care about, you know, the resume speaks to your past work experience, and we care about how well you've performed in the past. We get this through the recommendations as well, and some other questions we ask in the application. And the theory behind it, obviously, is similar to other schools, is, you know, past performance will, to some degree, be predictive of future experience. And so we want to bring in people who have excelled in the workplace up till now, looking at the resume, looking at the recommendations, primarily for that. We also ask for your transcript, your transcripts for your undergraduate and things that you have in graduate studies. And again, the idea is to try to predict your performance here at SOM through your past academic performance. And I would point out that we do, every year, we do analyze how those, what those outcomes are, both academically here at SOM and also in terms of other metrics we care about in terms of student experience and engagement, career search, not necessarily the outcomes, but how well you, in our estimation, you navigated that process, the career search process. So we do regress on all those outcomes to try and get a sense of what is predictive of success here and to refine our model, from year to year. So it's a very much an iterative process. But the transcripts and the academic background will speak to your performance here. They are predictive. We do obviously look at test scores, your GMAT or GRE, which we accept both, and we are agnostic as to which you take. That obviously is predictive of the first year to some degree. So we do look at that as well. But then we have some unique elements that I think just about every school has an essay or essays. We actually used to have it. I think when I started, we had three essays. We're down to one now. And the reason for doing that is to make space for the other elements of the application, for the video questions and now the behavioral assessment. The idea is to broaden the base of how we're looking at your candidacy, as I said before. So it's not just about writing essays, but it's about an essay, video questions, behavioral assessment, other elements that are, again, varied in terms of what we're looking for and how we're engaging with you. The single essay we have now asks you to describe your biggest commitment. The topic we've had for a couple of years, we like it. I don't know if we'll keep it in the future, but we still like it for this year. And the idea is, and we've developed, as I know you know, in conjunction with one of our organizational behavior faculty members who teaches on work, the meaning of work, whether it's a job, a calling, a career. And the idea is that to be successful at Yale and beyond, where we want our students, our graduates, to be action-oriented. So we ask about a commitment, but we want to know what you've done to demonstrate that commitment. So we're not making value judgments about what the commitment is, but really looking at what you did in support of that commitment, what actions, what behaviors you demonstrated in furtherance of the commitment. So that's really what we're looking for in the essay. And then we do have the video questions, which, for those who don't know, are 60 to 90 second responses that we ask you to make to three different questions that are various styles. One's more about our mission, one's about in the MBA, one's about a behavioral question, and one's what we call a thought question, which we give you a statement and ask you to agree or disagree and explain why. Again, we have a pretty light touch with this. It's not going to make or break your candidacy, but again, we wanted to get more of a sense of you from beyond the the paper or the written submission that you provide in the rest of the application.
Is the sense of you about your ability to articulate kind of on your feet and presence? Is that?
A little bit, yeah. So a little bit about your extemporaneous speaking ability, ability to think on your feet. And again, it's not, and we think of it as a plus factor. So it's very rare that your video question responses will be a negative in the application. It tends to be neutral or positive. So it will hopefully allow us to think more, give a closer look to someone we might not otherwise have looked at as closely. We tend not to use it to disqualify candidates. But it's that we also, at the time when we implemented this, you used it to replace the TOEFL. Or the IELTS, the English language test. So we don't require an English language test for applicants. The video questions were the reason for that, because now we thought it would make more sense for us to evaluate candidates directly ourselves. And again, that's trying to think about, instead of how to make this process more streamlined for us and applicants. So instead of taking and paying for a TOEFL exam, you do a video question, series of three questions that take about 15 minutes to complete, and you're done, and then that's all you have to worry about. So hopefully it's an easier process for applicants than it would have been to take the TOEFL. But we do look at it for English language ability as well.
Also, the TOEFL, I remember, I think it's gotten better, but I remember years ago talking occasionally to applicants who had very high TOEFL scores, and not only that, I could barely understand them, they could barely understand me. Yep. So And I'm a child of immigrants. I'm very used to accents.
And that's exactly why we did this. We observed that, you know, the TOEFL by and large is good. It's predictive. And it, maybe it's gotten better, but we noticed that there were applicants who scored very high in the TOEFL, but whose English was not good. And conversely, applicants who had low TOEFL scores, but whose English was fine. And we didn't want to be making decisions and either disqualifying people or moving forward with people for based on a test that was not as predictive as we would like. And so that's why one of the main motivations behind the video questions. And I will say, since it was interesting to see, since from the time before we implemented the video questions afterwards, when we would invite candidates to interview, because the video questions don't replace the interview, there was always a certain percentage of candidates who we would invite to interview whose English ability was just not up to par, not sufficient for the program. And after we did implemented the video questions, that number dropped dramatically.
Sure.
And so an ancillary benefit was we were much more efficient in who we were actually inviting to bring to the interview stage because of the video questions. So it's had that benefit on us operationally as well.
And what about the behavioral assessment? I mean, what is it? Is it a test, basically, the behavioral assessment? And is it something that Yale has developed, or is it something that you purchased, basically?
So it's interesting. So this is not a Yale instrument. We actually have looked at other instruments developed by Yale faculty and others. The for example, the Mesquite, which our president Peter Salovey helped develop, the Myers Salovey Caruso Emotional Intelligence Test, which we have not adopted. But the test that we are using, the behavioral assessment, was actually originally developed by the military, by West Point for officer development. It was purchased by ETS, the Educational and Testing Service, which administers the GRE. And we are working with them on this instrument. It's something that they use otherwise for professional development. It's not used by any other admissions office at any other level. But this is essentially a pilot for them and for us. This is the first time they've used it in a high-stakes context. We feel comfortable using it. So what the test is, it's a series of 120 statements, sort of pairwise statements, and you have to make a choice of which, and they're descriptors about, you know, my office is always clean. I have to get, you know, I make sure I complete all my, you know, my email inbox is empty by the time I leave work, or, you know, those types of things, or I like, you know, I'm comfortable with mass, or you know, those types of things. And you choose which statement of those two are most like you. And then it's adaptive. So by the end of the 120 statements, which take about 20 minutes to complete, it will develop a sort of a behavioral of your intra and interpersonal dimensions that we sort of are looking at. And it's inter and intrapersonal competencies. And so the idea is to get a picture of you, an aspect of your profile that's different than any other thing we're gathering elsewhere in the application, and doing it in a way that we feel is hopefully more objective, more consistent across candidates, and therefore fair than if we were trying to do something more subjective. Nothing's ever completely objective, but it's at least a little more, it's more consistent and we feel fair than if we were trying to kind of read the tea leaves by looking at an essay and you know, other aspects of the application and making those independent judgments or, you know, subjective judgments ourselves. And the motivation behind this, just that I won't go on too much longer, is much like the TOEFL, which, you know, where it's generally predicted, but there are some high scoring candidates who can't speak English and then some lower scoring who can, things like the GMAT and the GRE, you know, we see plenty of people who score high on those tests but come here and underperform, and see plenty of people who score lower on these tests come here and do wonderfully. And so we're trying to figure out what other qualities, what secondary and tertiary traits these individuals have that will help us identify, you know, the high score underperformers and the low score overperformers. And so that's what the behavioral assessment is meant to do. And the hope is that by having this and the other elements that we've built in that are go beyond grades and scores, we can actually expand the base and be more open to candidates who maybe have more modest test scores or more modest grades, but we see things that are candidacies that signal to us that they will be successful. And so we're really hoping this will increase the breadth of the class, the diversity of the class, and allow us to be more open to more candidates.
Very interesting. Fascinating. I recently had on a medical school admissions dean, highly experienced. She's been doing this for 20, 30 years. And she said that her school recently switched to having something called the CASPER, the C-A-S-P-E-R. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's being used by medical schools. It's considered a situational judgment exam. And what they found is that people who score well on the CASPER are those who tend to do well in their interviews. Now, realize that a tiny percentage of medical school candidates are actually interviewed. It's frequently, you know, it's much smaller than the MBAs. And she found it just to be a fantastic tool. It's just we'll never go forward without using that again.
That's interesting. I've often
And so again, operationally, it allows them to be much more efficient.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. That's really interesting. We talk to our medical school here off and on. And actually, for a few years, I've been speaking to other medical schools, Stanford and others, that do the MMI, the multiple mini interview,
which I
find very fascinating. We've had a difficult time trying to figure out operationally how to implement that structure because I do find that it's somewhat similar to that sort of the situational, the CASPER that you're describing. Yeah. But
they also switched to the MMI. This particular school recently switched to the MMI. And again, she found that a lot more accurate results simply, you know, because you get multiple people weighing in.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I can see how those would kind of just, hearing your brief description of the CASPER, how those would fit in together. And that is one of the, you know, we didn't talk about the interview, but that's one piece of the process that I think is...
Good segue.
And, you know, we, like most business schools, I think, have a one-on-one interview. So our interviews are conducted primarily by second-year students, sometimes admissions staff, who've only seen your resume, have not read your entire application. We try to have those conversations be as independent as possible. And they have some value. We've actually, a number of years ago, again, in conjunction with some of the dean's office here at Yale and some expertise they have, David Caruso, who, again, was one of the developers of the Mesquite exam and is an expert in interviewing, went to a structured interview. We very much, which is how we conduct our interviews. But there are limitations to a one-on-one interview. It can be very subjective. It can be very based on the particular dynamic and interaction between the interviewer and the interviewee. So the NMI has always been very appealing to me because it does broaden the base. You get multiple perspectives, and I think that smooths out and hopefully it reduces that subjectivity. Again, we haven't found a way to implement it operationally. And as a result, you know, we do interview, a significant number of candidates. I would say about a third of the applicants who apply are interviewed. About two thirds of the people we interview, we admit. But we try not to lean too heavily on the interview because we know the limitations, because we know that they are predictive, but they're also open to that subjectivity that we don't want to fall into that trap too heavily. So it does factor into the evaluation, but I think some candidates think it's, you know, it's the make or break that, you know, if you get to the interview stage and you do well, you're in, and if you don't, you're not. That's not how we look at it here at Yale. After the interview happens, we'll take the interview report, add it to the file. We'll review the admissions committee. We'll review the entire candidacy together with the interview as one data point, one piece of the picture. And we look at it all holistically in making a decision.
And also you're trying to create a class. So that's the other element. It's not just who the applicant is. It's how the whole thing fits together, right? So that's.
Exactly. So the interview itself is not necessarily an up or down itself, but we're looking to see certain things in the candidacy that can help, again, that might relate to other things we're seeing elsewhere, might confirm certain things we're seeing or help us answer questions that we have about other parts of the application. So it's not just about the interview in isolation, but how it relates, as you say, to the rest of the application and what we're seeing there.
And how does the recommendation fit into this? Yeah, I was about to say goulash, but you know what? It's more of a puzzle. Every piece plays a role.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And we do... and again, it's a balance to harkening back to the quotation you read from me that, you know, we want to be efficient, we want to be streamlined, we don't want to ask extraneous things, but at the same time, we want to have everything fit together and sometimes create some redundancies so that we're gauging certain qualities, certain traits at different points and in different ways to compare them against each other so that we are, you know, not relying on any single data point for to gain insights into certain aspects of a candidate's profile. The recommendations, you know, they can speak to a number of things, and those are challenging, I would say, because we don't want the candidate's evaluation to hinge on how, for example, the recommender's expansiveness, how effusive they are for various reasons versus other recommendations or other recommenders, how good their English is. So we try to control for those variables, which is why we have a very structured grid that we ask recommenders to use that uses behaviorally anchored cues to try and standardize across recommenders. We also are part of the GMAC, the Common Recommendation Form, which uses a very similar grid. This is something that Harvard and Stanford and Darden and we used, I think, primarily before that Common Rec, and now a number of schools have picked that up. So the idea is to try and control for those variables and try and standardize across recommendations, recommenders. That said, I think with every element of the application, there's no single piece that will make or break your application. It's not as though strong recommendations will get you in. You know, if there are some very concrete reservations and hesitancies from the recommenders, and we do see that, if they're not always best in the world level, there are sometimes that are various real things that are negative things that are in there that we take very seriously. But it's really trying to see how the recommendations relate to what you say in your essay, what your resume looks like, what your transcripts look like, the behaviors we're seeing in each of those elements, and how they all fit together. So it's like, sorry, long-winded answer for how we look at the recommendations.
And it provides you another perspective, an outsider's perspective, right? And if I think about all your answers to this question, which was a long question, a multi-part question, each element is really telling you something a little different about the candidate from a different perspective or different modality, as you said earlier.
I think that's right. Yeah, and from a different source. So we, the transcript will be, what your professors thought of you, the work experience and the recommendations are a third-party perspective. Your essay is from you yourself, as are the video questions. The behavioral assessment is you filtered through this third-party instrument. And so, again, we're trying to triangulate everything and kind of get a picture of you from these different elements, from different sources, using just sort of different modes of thinking, and really trying to get as full a picture of you as possible.
All right, great. Now, you mentioned that, you see that sometimes applicants with below average grades or below average test scores get in. So for the class of 2021, the class that just entered, the middle 80% GMAT range was 680 to 760. The middle 80% GPA range was 3.34 to 3.92. And I don't have the GRE range written down, but the median was 330 for the GRE. What do you look for those people who are below average? What gives you the confidence to admit them? Obviously, you're rejecting people with higher stats.
Right.
So, what gives you that confidence?
Yeah, and so it's a great question. There are lots of different things. And I would point out that those are the ranges for the class. Obviously, in terms of who we admit, the ranges are even broader. And that's within 80%. So we admit lots of people who are sort of even farther outside of that range.
I like to use the 80% range, because otherwise you get that bottom 10%, which is, and they think, oh, I can get in. And you know what? It starts to get a little iffy when you get down there. But anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, but you can. But we do a bit more broadly than the class suggests.
Yes.
So in terms of what we see in kids who maybe have softer grades and scores, I think it's one interesting thing. And it does speak to the fact that we're not looking for any one thing across the board in every candidate. And we do value diversity. And I think you'll probably hear that from other schools too. And diversity means many different things. It can be sort of race, ethnicity, sort of gender, citizenship, professional experience, and any number in other dimensions. So political thought, others. The idea is that we're trying to put together a class that is not where everyone's not identical to each other, but everyone is bringing something different. And for candidates who don't have some of the greatest scores, they can have their other things that they will bring. And even that's not one thing. It tends to be there will be some professional background, some exceptional professional experience and accomplishment that will make that candidate stand out. There can also be something about their background in terms of their distance traveled, in terms of the context of their application that will make put the grades and scores in context and also show qualities that we value very much and that would not appear in the academics or the testing, but that speak to the strength of the candidacy in other ways. Those are the types of things we will look at as we see candidates who maybe don't fit within that middle 80% range, but we think will be valuable additions both to the community here at Yale and also, as alumna or alumni after graduation.
Okay. Now, there's been in the last, certainly the last 6 months, I think it started earlier, kind of a steady drumbeat, if you will, of the sky is falling on full-time MBA programs, okay? And I think it reached a crescendo, at least a crescendo to date, in an article in the Wall Street Journal, is the MBA worth it? And the conclusion was no. I wasn't terribly impressed with this article, but I think that is a concern out there, especially since another drumbeat is that the country is headed towards recession. Right. So how would you address the sky is falling on the MBA program kind of point of view? And I think the more grounded concern about recession.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I think the momentum has picked up on this, or is the MBA worth it refrain in that bandwagon. Yeah, obviously, the caveat being that I'm an interested party here. I do have a perspective that's grounded in being in an MBA program. But I legitimately feel that, the value of the MBA has not diminished. It still has the same benefits to its graduates that it never did. You can look at things like, ROI, and it's still just as strong. In fact, it's stronger when you look at the first year salaries keep going up and increasing at top schools. I do think also that there are a number of different things happening that have contributed, I think, to the recent decline in applications. When you look at for non-U.S. applicants, so concerns over visa availability, the political climate in the U.S. For U.S. applicants, we've seen a softening there as well. The strong job market. Employers, right. I think, are working hard to try and keep people in their jobs because it's a tight labor market.
Right.
And I think these things are sort of temporary. I think that those will turn at some point. But the ROA is the same. And I think the skills you will get in an MBA, one other variable is the growth in one-year master's programs. And to the extent that those are picking off, we hear about, the level of overlap, and it's not huge, but the one thing that I've been thinking about, and we're going to look at the numbers, is, these one-year masters have been around just enough where early on, these are early career programs, those candidates would not have applied to the MBA anyway because they were early career. They probably would not have been in the MBA pipeline. Those programs have been around long enough now that we're starting to maybe see the absence of some of those MBA applicants because they got a one-year master's now.
That's true.
Those years later.
Yeah.
But I don't think those degrees are technical degrees. They don't have the same upside. They don't have the same benefit in terms of training you to be a leader and giving you the flexibility. I think the main value of the MBA program is that it gives you choice. It gives you flexibility. It allows you to do really whatever you want in the professional context. I have a legal background. So I went to law school and then practiced for a number of years. And I think the default belief was that getting a law degree was was the key to do whatever you wanted. You could use it. It's very flexible, and you could do whatever you want.
It was a good foundation for something.
Exactly. I really feel like that. I mean, I think that's possibly the case if you practice law for a few years. I feel like really the MBA is the degree that provides that flexibility and provides, you know, the breadth that allows you to switch from one career to another or have multiple career switches and really do whatever you want. And I think that value has not diminished. And I think it's underappreciated still. So again, a long-winded answer, but I think the application numbers have gone down in the last couple of years, but I don't think the value of the MBA has diminished at all. And I think, again, I'm an interested party. I think when the conditions change, then I think we'll see things, you know, return to a different equilibrium.
I think GMAC data also shows incredible satisfaction among alumni. If you look at their alumni surveys, that's the other thing. The other thing is a lot of focus, I think, on the sticker price of the MBA, but a significant percentage of MBA students get financial aid that significantly reduces that sticker price. The sticker price is kind of like what you pay retail, but many applicants, they don't end up playing retail, and they can only find that out if they apply.
Yep.
They might get it for half off, they don't know. They might get it for much less than what the stated price is.
I think that's right. I think that's the same with undergraduate, where the what people actually pay is much different than what the sticker price is. I actually, for a few years, I've mostly jokingly floated the idea that we don't even have a tuition because it's so variable. You know, it makes no sense to actually advertise a tuition or have a tuition because people pay different amounts. That's never gone very far, and I can understand why. But I think that's exactly right. And so our outgoing dean, Ted Snyder, he is quoted in a recent article about sticker price and the fact that business schools have really just kind of been on a slow march, pricing themselves out of the market. And I think there will be need to address. I think well, part of it is that not, you know, candidates not recognizing that you don't always. I mean, a good number of people pay sticker price, but then others don't. And so understanding that aspect, but also I think schools will need to try to correct and try to figure out what to do to make it. Price-wise.
Let's go back to the actual application process and applying. Since now we've convinced everybody it's worth it. What is the biggest challenge do you think applicants face in presenting a compelling case for acceptance? Or that's kind of the positive way of saying what's the biggest mistake they typically make. What's the challenge they face in making a compelling case for acceptance?
Yeah. I think there are a couple, and I think I don't know if these are different than what others have said from other schools. Probably not. I think these are probably pretty consistent things. A couple of things that I would point to on the sort of the more the macro scale, not the, you know, typos and those types of things, which obviously everybody needs to be mindful of. I guess two things I would point to. One is that we still see candidates who will try to shade their candidacy based on what they think the school is known for. So that, you know, if you're the marketing school or the finance school, you know, or the operations school or the technology school, whatever it is, you know, I am the marketing candidate here and the finance candidate there. That's really, I think that's a poor strategy for a number of reasons. The first is that I think there might have been a time when schools really were known for one thing. And that was sort of their area. I think that those days have long since gone. I think every top school is strong in a range of areas, and they're looking for candidates and students who are diverse and not just looking to do a single thing. So trying to play to what you perceive the school's strength to be or what the school's focus is, I think is probably a mistake. And also, obviously, it makes you look less strong. If you're trying to sort of shade or shape your candidacy in different directions, depending on what school you're applying to. I mean, you could possibly do that to some degree, but you're not going to be a marketing candidate here and a finance candidate there and credibly be able to articulate.
No, your experience will match it.
Exactly. And that's what we're looking for. I mean, as we're trying to put the different pieces of the puzzle together, there are times when there'll be disconnects and things won't sync up.
Right.
And, you know, those are red flags to us. And so, if you get too far away who you are as an individual, what you've done, what your true interests are, it's gonna raise flags for us. And so I think candidates who do that, and there's still some who do that, that can be a challenge. I also tend to say, you know, from a game theory perspective, it's not a smart move because there are, you know, if you think if you're applying to what you perceive to be a marketing school and you want to be a marketing candidate and other people are doing that as well, your reason for doing that is to increase your chances of admission and you want to stand out, but you're actually making yourself look similar to all these other candidates. So you're actually
But you're weaker out. Because you don't have the marketing background.
Exactly. And you're just looking like a lot of other people who say they wanted to go into marketing too. So I think it's so counterproductive and self-defeating. So that's one thing I would point out. The other is, and it may be somewhat counterintuitive to some degree, but I think it makes sense. Obviously, when you're applying to business school, you're applying to anything, to a job, to other opportunities, you want to present your strongest candidacy possible. You want to put your best foot forward. And I think that's right. The candidates I see who tend to be successful, though, are ones who don't ignore their weaknesses or don't try and run away from them. You know, there's no such thing, and other schools will say this too, there's no such thing as a perfect candidate. Nobody's strong across the board. And I think the acknowledging your weaknesses and incorporating them into your candidacy, I think can be helpful. First, because we will see them, and so you want to address them proactively and contextualize them and have them, you know, have us address them on your terms as opposed to our terms. But also because they show second level traits such as self-awareness, such as humility, things that we find to be important, that if you just kind of ignore them, you know, any weaknesses, you would present much differently. You would present as someone who really wasn't introspective, doesn't have a sense of yourself, is just kind of glossing over these weaknesses and the aspects of your candidacy that are less strong. And so I think it's not the typical approach that most candidates think of, but I think it can be helpful. And again, it's not as though you will lead with this huge sort of disqualifying quality about you, but it's that you some of the things that you see, some of the reasons maybe you want to get an MBA, you will talk about. And as a justification for wanting to get the MBA or how things you see you can improve in yourself. So that would be, I think, a second piece that I would point to. Second, it's not an inherent mistake across the board, but something that I think opportunities that candidates miss in the application process.
Thank you. That's a great answer. We're going to run a little bit over, but I just want to close with this last question. Is there anything you would have liked me to ask you?
That's a good question. I think that's the one step for how I stay so youthful after all these years, I don't know.
Okay.
No, I think we touched on so much, and I think we covered a lot of ground.
We have. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. And I guess, I don't know if I could turn around. The question about the MBA landscape is one that is always interesting to me, but just to ask what your take is on, you know, the value of the MBA and where we are now and if you have any thoughts on where you see it going.
I think the irony is I actually wrote a whole article. I was in the process of writing it when the article in the Wall Street Journal came out, and I was really ticked. I haven't published it yet. I think I will just publish it on our blog or perhaps on LinkedIn. But I think my answer would be a little bit more nuanced. Obviously, I'm a big fan of the MBA. I have an MBA myself. I feel it benefited me. I think that the cost of the MBA, the sticker price of the MBA, is a problem. At the same time, I think now is a fantastic time to go for the MBA because the application volume is down. It's a little bit easier to get into a top school. It's also, I think that there's more competition for the qualified candidates among the school, and that is leading to more financial aid. So that the fact that applicants are rejecting themselves from schools and choosing not to get an MBA because they fear that sticker price means that they're potentially missing out on life-changing opportunities. And so that's that. I think it's an individual decision that an applicant has to make looking at where they're at and where they want to go. If the MBA is the vehicle for taking them to where they want to go, is the benefit of whatever it is where they want to go, both in financially and non-financially, personal satisfaction, is that worth the cost both the full rate cost. If it's not, well, then you don't go unless you get a scholarship.
Yep.
Or you don't go to certain schools. You go to a less expensive school. Again, depends on what the individual's goals are. So basically, I agree with you, but a little bit more nuanced, I would say. There are some people for whom the MBA just isn't worth it, or the MBA isn't worth it unless they get into a certain programs. And that's okay. But I think that the idea that the sky is falling and it's a terrible time to get an MBA and the MBA isn't worth it because this guy went drinking with some guys who said it wasn't worth it. I mean, well, I just go drinking with the wrong people. That's all I can tell you. Okay. You know, again, the GMAC data shows overwhelming satisfaction. The salaries are good.
Yeah.
Is it right for everybody? No. You should be thoughtful and purposeful about your MBA decision. And then I think it can be definitely worth it and a fantastic experience and a tremendous benefit to one's career and life. So
yeah.
That's my answer.
Yeah, much more nuanced, I think, much more thoughtful than mine. And I would say two quick...
Well, we are in different roles, you know.
Two quick points I would say, or one thought. This past year, we did see more people, to the extent they declined our offer, who declined not for another school, but for professional opportunity, more so than in the past. So I think, you know, that speaks to, you know, a number of different things. But I wonder if, to your point, that people are sort of testing out the MBA, but, you know, not being willing to get it at all costs, but thinking about whether it's the right thing for the price or given the other variables they're considering.
Right. Timing. But yeah. I mean, I do think that the schools, I certainly hope they haven't killed the goose that's laying the golden egg with the constant. I mean, the price increases have well exceeded the rate of inflation. I got my MBA in the late 70s. And at the time, the quarter tuition was just about what I was paying in rent.
Mm.
Okay. So, and I wasn't a particularly glamorous apartment either. It was a very plain Jane apartment, non-security building, no pool. And, you know, that means that I could have gotten my full, again, I went to UCLA, so it was on the quarter system. So basically you're talking 6 quarters or 6 months rent in West LA, which was even then an expensive area to rent. You know, if you could get an MBA for 6 months rent, okay, so I think there is an issue there, but I still think it's an individual decision, as I laid out, and I think there's a lot going for it that the articles, the sky falling down articles, don't relate.
Okay? Yeah, no, that's right.
So, anyways, all right, Bruce, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I'm sorry if I kept you too long. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about Yale SOM's MBA program?
Sorry, what was that?
Where can listeners learn more about Yale SOM's MBA program?
Yeah, definitely. So our website, som.yale.edu, is a great place. And go to the admissions page. We have lots of information, lots of resources, events coming up, webinars, campus visits. So, and definitely feel free to email us at mba.admissions@yale.edu.
Sounds good. We'll include links in the show notes at accepted.com/338 to the sites that Bruce just mentioned, as well as to related articles and show notes. Check them out. They're all linked to from accepted.com/338. And a quick reminder, take advantage of Accepted's November special to improve your applications, apply with confidence, and save money. Use coupon code SAVENOW between November 15th and 22nd. Listener, thank you too for joining Bruce Delmonico and me for our 338th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with admissions deans like Bruce, or professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.